This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Tim Cook at Apple has drawn a line in the proverbial sand, but it's not like he made up his mind yesterday, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 18th of February, Thursday. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. If you're keeping track, and we are, Apple has until Tuesday to officially decide what it's going to do about the court order that it got, saying it has to help the FBI get into the iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino shooters. 5 business days was the deadline. Tuesday is where that takes us, but here's a thought. It's not like Apple, and really every tech company worth its salt, didn't know something like this was coming, that at some point they were going to have to choose between consumer privacy and lawfully issued orders of the court. Or if you put it another way, this whole episode is really just the tipping point for a corporate strategic planning process that's been going on for a good long while. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains Apple's business decision to take a stand.
Apple has helped law enforcement unlock phones before, but that was different, says Rich Mogul. He's a security analyst and CEO of Securosis.
Basically, what would happen before is Apple had a way using, you know, the equivalent of their existing repair tools. But what Apple's decided is the very fact that they could do that was a security vulnerability.
Mogul says after the Snowden revelations, and even to a certain extent before, Apple saw privacy and security as a way to differentiate itself from its competitors. And it decided it didn't want to be a gatekeeper anymore, says Jonathan Zittrain. He's a law and computer science professor at Harvard.
Apple has been trying to make, in this respect, the iPhone a product, not a service. It's just, you've got the phone, it's your phone. We, Apple, don't want anything to do with it from now on. With respect to the contents of the phone, if you want to gate them off from us and everyone else.
Zittrain says in the future, tech companies may build their product walls so high and strong they can't be breached no matter what. For now, Apple may get points for taking a stand on privacy, but Ben Schachter at Macquarie says this case may not have been the ideal moment to take that stand.
One of the challenges, I think, for Apple, Google, and others in this type of scenario is, do you come across as, you know, un-American, or do you come across as on the side of terrorists, or, you know, things that are easy to boil down to that sort of one glib statement.
But Schachter says Apple is a multinational company in a global economy. So for them, this isn't just an American issue. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
A word here in defense of some of those other companies that guy Tracy was talking to mentioned Google specifically, which I might perhaps have slighted yesterday while I was talking to Molly Wood for not having weighed in on the tech issue of the day. Late yesterday, the CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai is his name, did indeed tweet in support of Apple's stance. Tweeted tepidly, he did, but tweet anyway. Another tech story now, also about privacy in a way. You visit a hospital these days and digital information follows you wherever you go, from admitting to lab tests and what drugs you get. With that in mind, now imagine a modern hospital trying to function without its digital network. Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center, not all that far from our studios here in L.A., went back to the pre-computer era for about 10 days or so. The hospital's network was locked down by hackers using software known as ransomware. The hospital did pay the ransom, $17,000 worth, in Bitcoin as it happens, which is interesting, but not the point of this story. The story here, the good news, is that Hollywood Presbyterian is back online. The bad news is that they are not the only victims choosing to, or having to, pay up. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
Ransomware is a particularly pernicious hack. It can come from a website you visit or through email.
Ransomware is basically an encryption program.
Bruce Schneier is a cybersecurity expert at Harvard's Berkman Center.
It breaks into your computer, it encrypts your files, and then doesn't let you at them.
Hackers are using modern, highly sophisticated encryption, so fighting a ransomware attack can be virtually impossible. That means victims are left with two choices: say goodbye to all of their data, or pay the hackers to undo their damage.
You want to ask for a number that's low enough that the victim will pay and high enough to be profitable.
According to security firm Symantec, the average ransom is $300, and the firm says about 3% of victims pay. But because most do it quietly, Adam Kujawa with the cybersecurity firm Malwarebytes believes the number is a lot higher.
What we've always told people in the security community is do not pay the ransom. Never, ever pay the ransom.
Kujawa says that's because profitability is what's fueling ransomware's growth.
But unfortunately, some of these companies and some of these users have not employed backups. They have no way of getting the information back other than just paying.
The best chance of avoiding the problem, says cybersecurity expert Michael O'Riordan, is simple prevention, doing things like keeping software up to date.
People are not always as careful about protecting their machines as they could be, or they don't run, you know, up-to-date antivirus.
That allows ransomware attacks to go unchecked. Symantec detected almost 9 million of them in 2014, more than twice as many as the year before. I'm Novosafo for Marketplace.
There was mostly calm at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. You get a new pet, a puppy or a kitten maybe or whatever, and then comes the stuff, the toys and trainers, the organic superfoods, which that superfoods bit sounds like but cannot possibly be a joke because we spend $60 billion a year in the United States on our pets. And if the tech industry has anything to do with it at all, we are going to be spending even more on digital gadgets and gizmos that let you track your pet's every accomplishment. And with that in mind, our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood introduces us to the newest breed of canine, the quantified dog. Here's Molly.
Come here, buddy.
This is me getting my new puppy set up with an activity tracker.
What lifestyle would you like for Reggie? Average 15,000 bark points, lots of snuggle time, couple of walks a day, in the 50th percentile. That sounds awesome. Because you're just a baby.
I know what you're thinking. I'm a crazy dog mom. Fair enough. But there is a growing market for pet tech of all kinds. Monitors that take pet selfies, electronic puzzles and games to entertain our critters and build their brain power. And the newest category, pet wearables that track activity.
I had three cats, and one would spend quite a lot of money to know where your cat went at night. It's amusing, it's frivolous, but what the heck? It's certainly not harming the cat to have a tracker on its collar.
Peter Harrop is the chairman of ID Tech X. That's a market research firm that actually put out a report on wearables for animals. It estimates the market could be worth $2.6 billion by 2019. Now, to be fair, that includes devices that track livestock, racehorses, and, you know, the wolf population of Yellowstone. Davide Rossi is the CEO of FitBark. That's the tracker I tried out on my dog, Reggie. He is one of a group of entrepreneurs hoping to grab a sliver of that market, and he's got some research too.
This is a multi-billion dollar industry. 45% of households own a dog, yet 53% of us impose on them a lifestyle that's unhealthy. An active lifestyle is not one bit less important for dogs than it is for humans.
But are we really ready for the quantified canine? The market isn't old enough yet to answer that question, but I went out and asked some dog owners at Point Isabel, a dog park near Berkeley. It's got 23 acres, including a dog wash and a cafe. Are you aware that there are pet wearables now?
I was not aware that there are pet wearables.
How do you currently track your dog's activity?
I track my dog's activity by how crazy he's acting.
But even if they hadn't heard about dog activity trackers, some owners immediately saw the purpose.
Well, it might be good for the overweight dogs. Look at how fat my dog is. Maybe I need to know.
I met one woman who has 8 dogs. She said she would buy a tracker if it were $10 or $12 each. But the FitBark, a little gadget shaped like a dog bone with Bluetooth built in, that costs more like $70, and so do its competitors. At least one guy thought they would be great for business.
Well, I'm a dog walker, and I might have a lot of clients, and they have no idea what their dog's doing. And if their dog had a Fitbit, they would know exactly how I'm doing my job.
In the week or so that I tried my doggy activity tracker, I did think it was kind of fun. And I'm not trying to brag, but little Reggie is pretty gifted.
His average bark points per day are higher than 46% of small-sized dogs of puppy age, 89% of all Chihuahuas, and 91% of Fit Bark dogs.
But once I figured out my dog's routine, the data just didn't seem as useful. And that is a broader problem. Wearable makers are still trying to convince humans to buy into activity trackers. Most people abandon them within about 6 months. I mean, look at Fitbit. Its stock hit an all-time low recently. So whether this market takes off or rolls over remains to be seen. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
Rolls over. Get it? If you want to get a closer look at this whole quantified dog thing and to see Molly's new puppy, too, Reggie, he's a cutie, we've got a video of the whole thing at marketplace.org. The business terminology word of the day today is vertical integration. The industry of choice on this Thursday is movies. Fandango, the world's biggest online movie ticket seller, is continuing its push into all things movie-related. Last month, they bought MGo, that's a video-on-demand site. Now it has shelled out for Flixster, kind of a movie-related social network, and the movie review site Rotten Tomatoes. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
10 years ago, Fandango was happy just selling us tickets.
We have your movie tickets. We are Fandango.
Now, says Fandango president Paul Yanover,
the vision of the company is provide people everything that you want to have a relationship with movies.
Buying a ticket, streaming a movie at home, and getting advice, sharing opinions.
People are researching entertainment just like they're researching what television or toaster to buy.
Rebecca Lieb is an independent media analyst. She says a tie-up between Fandango and Rotten Tomatoes takes away any friction. You read about a good movie and buy a ticket. But isn't there a conflict between a company like Fandango that wants to sell us tickets and a site like Rotten Tomatoes that aggregates movie reviews? Omar Akhtar is an analyst at Altimeter.
Well, it really does depend if you think that Fandango's evil or they have ambitions to not be evil.
An evil Fandango could try to skew movie ratings. A non-evil Fandango could capitalize on the credibility of Rotten Tomatoes and maybe make it easier to shell out $14 for a ticket. I put the question to Fandango's president, Paul Yanover.
We intend to operate Rotten Tomatoes as an independent brand, and the metaphor for us is like a news bureau inside a large media company.
Fandango, owned by Comcast, bought Rotten Tomatoes from Time Warner Inc.'s Warner Brothers. So Rotten Tomatoes is already used to dealing with a media conglomerate corporate overlord. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's like gaining 1,000 pounds over 5 years and then deciding you're going on a diet. And then in 6 weeks, you're expected to lose all that weight.
Kind of tough when you run a clothing company. American Apparel and another conversation from the corner office. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 40 points today. 0.25% ended at 16,413. The NASDAQ off 46 points, 1%, 4487. The S&P 500 down 9 points, 0.4%, 1917. Seem like there's a Lazy Boy store on every shopping strip these days? That's its strategy. Close U.S. factories, open more stores, sell recliners made overseas. Lazy Boy earnings up, shares up 18%. That drop in the NASDAQ today, the AAA whales splashing around is what that was. Alphabet, a.k.a. Google, down 2%. Amazon, a.k.a. Amazon, down 1.7%. Apple, down 1.9%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.74%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Native Americans are, generally speaking, in far worse health than the rest of the country. They face lower life expectancy and far greater prevalence of diseases. And that extends to dental care, too. Preschoolers in Native communities have four times more cavities than white kids do. And since a lot of dentists don't take Medicaid, it can be incredibly difficult to get care to where it's needed. One solution a lot of tribes are trying is hiring a new type of dental practitioner called a dental therapist. They do simple procedures like cleanings and fillings and extractions. But dentistry is a business with only so many customers to go around. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from our help desk at WHYY.
Colorado-based dentist Terry Batliner has seen what poor dental health and a lack of access to care does to Native American kids.
Now, what this really looks like is a three-year-old with all of their teeth decayed down to the gum line. You just see roots sitting in the gums.
Among Native American adults, 68% have untreated tooth decay. That compares to 26% of all U.S. adults. In Alaska, tribes think they've got a fix. For the past decade, they've hired and trained more than 30 dental therapists.
We're going to try to get every single tribe in the nation that has dental programs to employ this strategy.
That's the National Congress of American Indians president, Brian Cladisby. Intertribal organizations representing some 105 tribes and pueblos have passed resolutions supporting dental therapy. As that momentum builds, so is the opposition from the American Dental Association. The ADA and their local dental societies have fought legislation in 12 states.
We're fighting for what's best for the public.
Dr. Jonathan Schenken, a spokesman for the ADA, says bringing in dental therapists doesn't get to the root of the problem.
It's not reducing the overall burden of disease in these populations. The question is, what more can be done?
Schenken says sugary food consumption as well as poor oral health habits are to blame. A new dental therapy pilot project just underway in Oregon should help build evidence whether this novel approach can help. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
It's rare that I set up an interview on this program by referring to a different interview, but I've thought it through, and there's really no other way to do it. A couple of years ago, I had a chat with Dove Charney, the founder and at the time the CEO of American Apparel. It was, as I said at the time, hands down the weirdest corner office interview I had ever done. I mention it because the other day I went back over to the American Apparel factory right here in downtown L.A., to talk to Paula Schneider, the woman who took Charney's place. I said took Charney's place, but what I should have said was took over after Charney got fired for all kinds of alleged misconduct, sexual and otherwise, and oh yeah, the company's terrible financial performance. So terrible that American Apparel just got out from under bankruptcy protection a couple of weeks ago, leaving the question of where the company goes from here still kind of up in the air. And that gets us to today's conversation from the corner office, Paula Schneider from American Apparel.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
All right, so this is really funny, actually, because the last time we were here, it was not like this. This is bananas.
You never see this anywhere else. We have three floors of sewing, and we have two floors of cutting.
Wait, summer's coming. Stars and Stripes bikinis?
That's right. Look at
there
it. Those are the bikinis for summer.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi.
These are so cute. We'll sell lots and lots of those.
Oh, no, I bet you will.
Yep.
I bet you will.
We're going to head down here.
All right.
Essentially, you know, there's seven floors to this
right.
building, seven floors
yep.
to the next building, and then we have four other facilities in Los Angeles. So
remind me, how many people here?
In this building's a little over 3,000. Okay, and overall, in total,
mm-hmm.
We're about less than 8,000 people.
Okay.
So quite a few peeps.
And this might not be a really great way to start an interview off on the right foot, but this company has been a hot mess for years. Years and years and years. Why did you take this job?
Because it's a fantastic brand and because of what it does. You know, it keeps so many people employed. There's so many people that eat off of the plate of American Apparel. And it's the tent pole for manufacturing in the United States, and it sort of goes with my own ethos. I lean left in politics. I'm all for immigration reform. I'm all for LGBT rights. It sort of fell right in with what I believe. And I didn't know, obviously, it was going to be as contentious as it was during the last year of all the things that we packed in here.
Yeah.
So.
When you got here, though, not knowing what was going to happen, but when you got here, were you surprised by what you found?
I would have to say yes. Because, you know, it got to such a massive size without a lot of processes and procedures in mm-hmm. place, which, you know, that was the power of the brand. The brand got it here, but it wasn't sustainable. Wasn't sustainable at that level unless you have, you know, unless you have a pre-production department, unless you have a planning department and a mm-hmm. forecasting department, and you know when your raw materials are coming through. And, you know, it wasn't like they had nothing, because they made 50 million units a year.
Right.
But it was a very herky-jerky motion. There was a lot of overtime that happened, and, you know, it wasn't well thought out or planned.
We're standing here in a, whatever, some conference room with product all over the walls.
We call it our war room.
War room, okay. Tell me, pick one of these and tell me why you decided to sell it.
Okay.
And there's pants and T-shirts and dresses and all kinds of stuff.
If I'm picking one of the main thrusts that we have for spring, we're doing a whole new group of T-shirts. And when I say...
A whole new group of T-shirts?
Whole new group of T-shirts.
How many groups of T-shirts can one do?
Well, one can do a lot of better T-shirts than some of the ones we have. I think that the men's T-shirts have held and withstood the test of time. Women want something new. And a lot of the T-shirts that we had were even in women's, were of a more masculine fabric. Heavier weight fabrics, more like a guy's T-shirt.
Yeah.
And the world has changed dramatically in that area. And if you don't own the T, you know, that's what we should be owning.
Right.
So we came out with, you know, some lighter weight cottons. We came out with some modals. We came out with, you
modals,
know,
we're gonna, what are modals?
Modals, if you touch the fabric, you'll see. It's just a fabrication.
A little stretchy.
And silkier. See?
That's nice.
See?
Heavy. Though it's a little heavy.
Well, it's drapey.
I mean, not in a bad
it's
way.
It's drapey.
It's okay,
very
so
drapey.
That's
it's
me
very
not
feminine.
The lingo.
A guy's not going to wear this.
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No.
Not even with a low cut back?
That's so funny, because I was like, boy, that's a really low front. And
yeah.
I just, sorry.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Well, you know, our girl could wear it either way.
Right. That's it.
But, you know, we're working on our women's business and making sure that we have the right product in the stores. Men's business, we've walked a lot of our men's business over the
what
last...
What does that mean? That gotten means, rid of?
No. Our men's business has tapered down over the last few years because we haven't made it a priority.
Huh.
And if you look at declining sales, the majority of the declining sales have been in men's. So there's a big focus for us in men's.
Huh.
You know, getting pants in that fit and getting, you know, some new bodies in for men's. So that's what we're working on there, too.
Other than... actually making money, right?
Yeah.
Well,
that's key.
Which is always a good metric.
We're going to get there.
What you being a process person, right, and having brought some structure here, mm-hmm. what
can I
are
be a
your,
creative person that knows process?
You totally can. You totally can.
Because that's what I would rather
you
be.
You being the creative person that you are, but who brings process to this company,
yeah.
What's your metric going to be? What spreadsheets are you going to look at and go, we're
sell-through by style.
Sell-through by style?
Sell-through by style.
What does that mean?
That means every week you look at what's selling.
Yeah.
And you can see if the percentage that it sells through, you know, and how quickly it's selling. Because then that gives us basis, right? It gives us some analysis for us to look at, hey, that worked for us because it was made out of 2x2 rib and it was a bodysuit and it was, you know, whatever it might mm-hmm. be. And then how do we expand upon those categories to get more people to make the brother, sister, cousin of that item?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this is pretty basic. This is not, I'm not, you know, like coming in here as a guru and saying I'm reinventing the wheel to do that. That's what people in retail do.
Is it unfair to call you a turnaround specialist?
No, whether it's unfair or fair, it kind of is. And
it's just a fact.
It's just the way that, you know, I didn't really start my career thinking that I was going to go in and be that person that turned things around. You never do. You go into something and you're sort of sold one bill of goods and you start the job and then you realize, oh, crap. You know, this is not an easy turnaround. This is it's like gaining 1,000 pounds over 5 years and then deciding you're going on a diet. And then in 6 weeks, you're expected to lose all that weight. I mean, you know, we've lost money since 2010. You know, the turnarounds are expensive. You have to invest in the businesses. You have to invest in product. You have to invest in people. You have to invest in systems. Every investment here has to be made.
So I'm going back to that first question I asked you, which is why did you take this job? Maybe the answer is almost you couldn't fail.
Oh, no. No, this is a very, very challenging turnaround. There's a million pieces and parts to it. You know, we're putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, and we you know, don't even have all the parts for Humpty to be put back together again. The reason that I took this job is because it's an incredible brand and because I can see that there's so many things you can do with it. And, you know, and we're exploring all of those options.
Paula Schneider, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We took a crew along with us. We've got pictures of what a Made in America garment factory looks like from the inside at marketplace.org. Also, there's a longer version of my chat with Paula Schneider on our Corner Office podcast, and there was a ton of stuff we had to leave out. So really, check it out. Available, of course, wherever you choose to get your podcasts. This final note on the way out today, you know how Wall Street types sometimes say they knew the housing bubble was going to crash when they heard that their barber owned three homes? Here's the corollary for the smartphone market. The Mobile World Congress starts in a couple of days, and one of the big product rollouts is going to be a smartphone made by Caterpillar. Yes, the big yellow construction machinery making company, Caterpillar. Cool part is, it's going to have a thermal imaging camera on it, which, yes, I suppose could be useful at construction sites. And with that, we are out of here. The Dow gave up 40 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ down 46 points, 1%. The S&P 500 down 9 points, 0.4%. All in all, though, fairly calm. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.